I think the most important thing for us to do is to recognize that inside Bush are parts of ourselves, and inside parts of ourselves are parts of George Bush.
Any war is a dangerous thing, and it puts people's lives at risk.
Anybody with half a brain, our nation is well qualified with individuals who would fit that description, would recognize that the last thing in the world you want in the Middle East of all places is more instability.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Wednesday, December 18th, 2002. I'm Verna Avery Brown. A German newspaper reporter assigned to the United Nations has obtained an unedited copy of the Iraqi document submitted to the UN Security Council outlining the status of Saddam Hussein's weapons arsenal. Andreas Zumach, a reporter for the German daily newspaper Die Tageszeitung, says the unedited version lists 24 U.S. firms and at least 80 German firms that supported Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction program. He spoke with Peace Watch earlier today from his home in Geneva, Switzerland.
I published the 24 U.S. companies. This is from the copies I have. There are 24 U.S. companies who, since 1976, at least till early 1991, right up to the beginning of the Gulf War, supplied very important material to the nuclear weapons program, to the biological weapons programs. Most of the anthrax Iraq now has came from U.S. Laboratories, provided a lot of know-how in the field of nuclear weapons building, a lot of machinery, and it was 24 U.S. companies plus roughly 50 companies, subsidiaries from foreign companies, subsidiaries who are based in the U.S., and who did all this mostly illegal dealing with Iraq at the time through U.S. licenses or at least through U.S. customs. And what is even more striking is that five departments of the administrations, both of Presidents Ronald Reagan and George Bush Sr., actively participated and licensed and okayed many of these deals. The Department for Defense, naturally, the Department of Commerce, Department of Agriculture, Department of Energy. So if I take this all together, I would put the U.S. on rank two after behind Germany in terms of how much and how important the contribution was to arming up Saddam Hussein.
So when the U.S. says they know that Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction, they would certainly be in a position to say so, given the increased or the level of activity that they had, the involvement that they had in supplying these things to him.
This is true. I would still argue that about 90% of what Saddam Hussein did have till 91, until then everything or most of it was destroyed during the 90s, the U.S. knew about it, one way or the other. What is the new thing about this report, as far as the U.S. is concerned, that never before this whole U.S. involvement, both by companies, by subsidiary companies of foreign enterprises based in the U.S., and by governments, and by the weapons laboratories, I forgot to mention, Lawrence Livermore and Sadrina and Alamos, has been put in a comprehensive picture in one document. So far you had bits and pieces there. You could find some CIA report. You have some congressional reports in Washington. There are a number of articles that have been published over the last 15 years. But never did you have it in one complete picture.
And I think, so what does the big picture look like?
The big picture looks like what I tried to describe, that the importance the United States of America played since 1975 in building up the arsenal of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, nuclear, biologically, to a lesser degree chemically, missile, conventional weaponry, underlines how big the U.S. role was. And this is something the public in the U.S. either never knew from the very beginning or it has forgotten since long. Same phenomena I see here in Germany with the German companies. I reported already in the late 80s, the first published the first companies in the early 90s. And the knowledge the German government had about it. But when I published my report yesterday where I put the 80 German companies in, most reaction was, oh, we didn't know about that, yeah, which is ridiculous, because at least for the time period till 1991, till the Gulf War, things should be known.
So your information did not provide that there was any activity from the U.S. after the Gulf War?
Correct. At least in the parts of the document I saw, there is no indication, with one potential slight but very indirect exception. We will publish a story tomorrow, since the five permanent members of the Council have decided to exclusively keep the information. We simply decided to publish everything which is in the document on companies, laboratories and government participation from these five countries. So we will have all the lists in our paper tomorrow, and we will say that at least two members of the Security Council, permanent members, have been violating the sanctions and the embargo on arms in the 90s and even up to last year. The one is Russia, and the second one is China.
What do you glean from all of this? What is the bottom? What is the main point of your article?
The main point of my article is to try to remind the world, meaning especially the citizens in those countries, which are mostly responsible for the decisions to be made in the next few weeks, that whatever Saddam Hussein did have in the 70s, 80s, and whatever he still might have till today, big might, we don't know, did not fall from sky, was not cooked up in some close cave in Iraq, but to 98% came from outside, and most of it came from us. Much more came from the West than from the back Soviet Union or from Russia. And that therefore there is a certain hypocrisy in many of the public arguments that are being made today by those people who argue we should conduct a war against Saddam Hussein. I'm not saying he's a saint, quite the opposite. I know the country, it's a bloody dictatorship. But I think the war would be the wrong way. It would not solve the problem. And to try to cover up the responsibility many of our countries, governments, companies did have and still have for the problem that is there is the wrong way. And I think if people would know, and especially in the U.S., more people would know more, maybe the propaganda leading to a war would not be that simple.
Andreas Zumas reports for the German daily paper Die Tageszeitung.
See the flags waving, so bravely they fly. The old men all cheering, the young girls all cry. The train pulls away, you can hear the drum roll sound. Another young boy going on to the killing ground. A year passes slowly, and now he's coming home. In a railroad baggage car he lies all alone. In a flag-draped coffin they carry him down. Another young boy home from the killing ground. The newspapers tell of a funeral and soon the old men meet together up in the judgment room. They look down the register to see who might be found to take a young boy's place out on the killing ground. Why did our mothers give lives to you and me to be gambled away far over the sea? When will the young people turn this world around and send all those who make the wars onto the killing ground?
Utah Phillips, The Killing Ground. Women for Peace, Code Pink and other D.C. anti-war activists sang Christmas carols at the home of U.S. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld last night. They were trying to help Rumsfeld understand that bombing people is naughty. They dressed up in the holiday spirit and distributed cider and cake to passerbys. David Russo from the Independent Media Center of Washington, D.C. brings us some of their carols and opinions and Medea Benjamin's address to the press, who finally showed up for an anti-war event.
Vigil. We have been out in front of the White House for the last month, every single day, 7 days a week, asking the president and this administration to not go to war with Iraq. And tonight we mark our first month anniversary by coming to Donald Rumsfeld's house to sing Christmas carols and ask Donald and his wife Joyce to come out and join us for some fruitcake and some cider, and perhaps to take these toys that we have here and bring them to the Iraqi children. Our message is a very simple one. We say, drop toys, not bombs. We feel that that's not only the right thing for the Iraqi people, but it's the right thing for us. Because we know that if we go ahead with this preemptive strike against Iraq, that we, the women, our families, our children, our communities, will be less safe. We know that it will unleash a wave of anti-American sentiment that will come back to haunt us by provoking more terrorist attacks here at home. And we say the way to make peace around the world is to show our love. So we were here tonight in the spirit of Christmas to show our love for that human family.
We want some peace, we cheer, we sing, we dance. Oh, you better not shout, you better not cry, you better not pout, I'm telling you why. Code Pink is coming to town.
The Code Pink play on the color-coded alert, the security alert, Code Red being the highest level alert. And the Code Pink is coming from millions of women and our male friends who are saying that we have to find the nurturing and the compassion and the love, and that is what will make us safe.
Don't make war, don't make war, don't invade Iraq. Use the money for the poor, not weapons to attack. Drop the bombs, don't drop bombs, inspections are the way. Let's spread peace around the world, not blow them all away. We need healthcare, we need homes, our liberties to stay. We don't want a war for oil, it's not the price we pay. No, 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 no,
mistake. Money for the poor, not weapons to attack. Hey! We have tried to contact Mr. Rumsfeld at the Pentagon many, many times. Not only do they not answer our calls, they laugh as if the Pentagon doesn't have to account to the people. So we came here instead.
And we feel that this is the time of the holiday season. It's a time to reflect on our actions. It's a time to make resolutions for the new year. And we're here to say to Donald Rumsfeld that the holiday spirit means looking deep into your heart and understanding that you cannot make peace by waging war. As women particularly, we feel that he is putting our families at risk, our communities at risk. We don't want to kill Iraqi women and children. We don't want soldiers, whether they're American or Iraqi, to die for what we think is a war for oil. We're very concerned that the U.S. government seems uninterested in making the inspections work. In fact, they're looking for an excuse to invade Iraq. And we are here to say, let the inspections move forward, and let's find alternatives in general to resolving our conflicts, that we can't make war and think that will lead us to peace.
Well, you better not try, you better not try, you better not foul, I'm telling you why. Good pink is coming to town.
What's your name?
My name is Victoria Cunningham.
And how did you get involved with Women for Peace Code Pink?
I actually heard them first on Pacifica Radio and thought I should go down and see what was going on. I volunteered with the vigil a couple of days, and now I'm working in there in the offices. I will be with them at least through March, and hopefully in March there won't have been a war, so it'll be done on International Women's Day.
Don't make war, don't make war, don't invade Iraq. Use the money for the poor.
A little holiday cheer from the Women for Peace caroling at U.S. Secretary of War Donald Rumsfeld's house. Thanks to David Russo from the Independent Media Center in D.C. and Reem Kathuda, Peace Watch producer for WPFW Pacifica Station in Washington, D.C. for that segment. Two chiefs of U.S. ground forces challenged Deputy Secretary of War Paul D. Wolfowitz on the effectiveness of an attack and what effect that might have against Iraq's president. The camps were split on how fast Saddam Hussein would fall. Wolfowitz, along with other senior Pentagon officials, believed that it would be a cakewalk. In a public address, the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, fielded questions about the possible strikes on Iraq.
We keep hearing from some military analysts, military experts, that war with Iraq might be a cakewalk, that in fact the Iraqi forces might fold very quickly. How does that square with your assessment of how war with Iraq might go?
Well, Dick Myers and I have both responded from this podium that that's, in our view, not the way to look at this situation. First of all, any war is a dangerous thing, and it puts people's lives at risk. And second, I think that it is very difficult to have good knowledge as to exactly how Iraqi forces will behave. A part of it will depend on a whole series of things in the event they were to evolve and occur that could affect their behavior favorably or unfavorably. And since those things we can't predict, first of all, we don't know what the president will decide or what anyone else will decide or if there'll be a use of force. But if there were to be such a decision, it's not knowable in what the context might be. And that would affect, one would think, how Iraqi forces would behave. We do know that in a matter of hours, some 60, 70, 80,000, not hours, maybe days, it was two or three days, dropped their weapons and surrendered very quickly in the Desert Storm. What would happen this time is an entirely open question.
Mr. Secretary,
do you want to answer that?
I would just say there's nobody involved in the military planning, to include the Secretary or any of the senior leadership in this building, I think, that you'll find that would say that this sort of endeavor, if we were asked to do it, would be a cakewalk. I mean, it's just not how we characterize it.
Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and Joint Chief of Staff Richard Myers also disagreeing with Assistant Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz's assessment of the Iraq war as being an easy war is Edward Peck. Speaking with Peace Watch earlier this afternoon, Peck, who's the former chief of mission to Iraq and deputy director of the White House Task Force on Terrorism in the Reagan administration, expects a far more difficult task ahead.
I think that the civilians in the Pentagon, who represent a factor of our society that's been trying for some way to overthrow Saddam Hussein, at least since they've been in power with this administration, would use every means possible, that's fully understandable, to justify what it is they want to do, and would tend, therefore, to discount anything that doesn't fit with their plans. If I were in a position of making decisions in this country, I would tend to listen far more carefully to the people with military and Middle East experience than to a bunch of folks who have neither, which is to say the ones who are hyping this plan. Saddam Hussein, I hate to say this because Americans blanch at the thought, Saddam Hussein is actually quite popular in his own country. And proof of that came to us, or should have, very obviously, on September the 11th last year.
What do you mean by that?
Well, on September the 10th of last year, the President of the United States had a 52% approval rating. And after the horrors of September the 11th, if you remember, his approval rating jumped to 96%. Not because people liked him anymore or agreed with his policies more than they had before, but because the nation was under attack. And when that happens, people rally behind the leader. And Iraq has been under attack now for something approaching, 12 years?
Mm-hmm.
So Saddam Hussein, even by people who do not like him and would like to see some other form of government, they will back him because he is defending their nation against a perceived enemy.
How might the worst-case scenario look, in your opinion? Experts have said that Saddam Hussein is not the kind of person that you want to back into a corner, that such pressure might actually prompt him to use chemical or biological weapons.
Yeah, you know, in forecasting the future, whether you're doing it on a radio network or for the U.S. government or anywhere else, is a pretty tricky thing. What I think is the real problem, you know, it isn't Iraq and Saddam Hussein that pose the danger that everybody in the Middle East is worried about. It's that even after Saddam Hussein is gone, what happens then? Experts say that the country will either implode or explode, which either one of which is a disaster. But over and above that, you're going to destabilize the region. And anybody with half a brain, our nation is well qualified with individuals who'd fit that description, would recognize that the last thing in the world you want in the Middle East of all places is more instability. And you're quite likely to get that when you step in and try to topple a regime.
Of course, there are plans in the work to have a General Tommy Franks in Iraq in the event that Saddam Hussein is fallen, in a plan for regime change.
It's a funny thing. We had a let me give you a quote. Listen to this now. If you toppled Saddam Hussein, what kind of government are you going to get? And what kind of credibility will that government have if it's put in power by the United States military? And how long does the United States military have to stay in position to support that government? And what happens to the people in it when you leave?
Some have said it will become the 51st state.
Well, but you know who said that? But I just quoted. That's a quotation, as close as I can get.
Mm-hmm.
That was Richard Cheney, Secretary of Defense in 1991. You see, he understood then, but he doesn't now. You can't do that. I mean, you know, this is the Middle East, folks, where the United States is not terribly popular for reasons which you can consider valid or not. That doesn't change the issue. The Department of State now has an undersecretary whose job is to win the hearts and minds of the people in the Middle East by having them get to know us. But the problem is, you see, that they do know us, and they don't like what they know.
I would imagine that history bears out some answers to some of those questions you were just posing.
Yeah, history.
The Shah of Iran.
Well, the Shah of Iran, yeah, there's a guy who we thought was absolutely invincible. He falls, forgive me now, he falls into the same category as the Iraq opposition groups who will tell the American public that they, the Iraq opposition groups, are supported, loved, and revered by, you know, 128% of the people in Iraq, up from 121% just 6 months ago. Well, the last person who had ridiculous numbers like that was the Shah.
And we all know what happened to him.
Yes, we do. One of the reasons that the United States backed Iraq with everything we could lay our hands on during the war with Iran was that we feared, perhaps for good reasons, what might happen if Iran actually surged over into that part of the world and Iraq was the only nation that could stand in its path. And there's nobody who could do it now if tomorrow the Iranians decided that they would relaunch their campaign to spread, you know, Shiite fundamentalism through that part of the world. Iraq is a military non-entity in an economic ruin and could not prevent in any way, shape, or form an Iranian move to the east. So what we're doing is strategically dumb, as well as being stupid, in my view, in all the other ways.
Ambassador Peck, I'm going to ask you to sort of read tea leaves here a bit. Given your knowledge as former chief of the mission to Iraq and deputy director on the White House Task Force on Terrorism under the Reagan administration, you're reading the signs and the reports just like everybody else. Do you think that the war is imminent?
I fear that unless people can convince President Bush, and I do not think he's getting good advice, unless they can convince him of the dangers inherent and the possible alternative ways of dealing with the issue, that, yeah, we'll go to war because we spent an awful lot of time and effort, the administration, in whipping up a froth and putting the worst possible slant on any bit of news that comes out. So, yeah, I fear it. And we will pay, that's the other thing I fear, a horrible, dreadful price for this in many places in the world for a long time to come. Here's my bottom line is this, that the epitome of patriotism, in my mind, is to ensure that the President of the United States knows what the people think so that he can make decisions based upon their desires and attitudes and so on. See, the President of the United States works for me. I don't work for him. I am his boss. He is not mine. And if the nation is not able to tell the president what it is they think and fear and want, and we're being pretty neatly stifled, both intentionally and otherwise, then I think serious dangers lie ahead, one of which, as you point out, could easily be a war in the Middle East with no easy out, with lots of losses of life in the war and in all the aftermath, not just there. But a lot of other places as well.
Many supporting the president's war agenda like to intend to dismiss the millions of Americans who oppose rushing in unilaterally into war without evidence that Saddam actually has any weapons of mass destruction. Like to dismiss those Americans as naive and uninformed. You signed on to the Win Without War ad in the New York Times. Given your experience, your vast experience and knowledge, do you sincerely believe that there are diplomatic channels that will help us avoid war with Saddam Hussein?
Oh, my goodness, yes. We have used none of them. We have not spoken to Iraq on any level, on any subject, anywhere for the past 12 years. And this is a country which sends a man like Colin Powell out, and here is an individual who is respected by everyone except the other people in the administration, I think, to tell Pakistan and India that unless they talk, the only alternative is war. Well, listen to that now, because we don't talk to Iraq. You don't have to intermarry or go to each other's cocktail parties. But if the Israelis and the Palestinians should talk, why aren't we talking to Iraq? I fail to understand, because you might be able to find some way out of the box.
Some dialogue.
A little dialogue goes a long way. At the height of the Cold War, when the United States knew without the slightest doubt that the Soviets were in a position to blast us off the face of the earth just by pushing a button, they had an embassy in Washington. We had one in Moscow. We had committees and delegations and exchanges and all of that. Not because we loved him and trusted him, but because we didn't, you know. And that's the way you avoid really bad things, by seeing if there isn't some other path. And we refuse to do this with Saddam Hussein because he's not a nice guy. But Sharon doesn't have a very high opinion of Arafat, or vice versa. But we're only asking him to talk to see if there isn't some other alternative.
Well, if the agenda is really to go to war, then there's no need to talk.
That is exactly right. You put your finger directly upon it. If you want to go to war, the last thing you want to do is talk. And our guys want to go to war.
Former U.S. Ambassador to Iraq, Edward Peck, will have the second half of that discussion with Mr. Peck in tomorrow's program. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.